Welcome to the second to last sales lunchtime seminar of the term. We're extremely fortunate that we have Privatdozent Dr. Max Klunert from Vienna here today, who's going to talk about the internal market. He received his law degrees in Vienna, a master's from Amsterdam, and his second doctorate from the Economic University of Vienna. He has been a visiting fellow in several distinguished universities across Europe, and is currently working for the Austrian government. Welcome, Marcus.
Thank you. Yeah, so thanks for inviting me, and I'm going to talk about a topic which I perhaps in what I sent out had a little bit a different title, but it's about the same thing. I just renamed it to make it sound a little bit more catchy. And so I want to talk about harmonization and what we mean with that when we talk about this concept. And I spent 1 year at the European Commission working in a legislative unit, so we were writing a directive, and that was a really interesting experience for me. And when I quit Brussels, there were several questions I asked myself, and the first one was, can there be a special regime for stricter measures, or measures out of the regulatory scope of a directive? So can there be sort of a separate special regime that the legislator can create when it allows member states to have stricter measures? The second thought, or the second question I was asking myself was, what has the legislator to do in order to take away reasons of justifications from the member states? So what does it have, what does it take to prohibit member states to rely on certain reasons of justification in order to justify their national measures? The third question was, and this is just like now before I really start my slides, just to give you the sort of like the key questions I'm gonna address here. The third one was, is there a limit to the creativity of the legislator with those legal bases in the treaties that mandate minimum harmonizations? Yeah, I'm going to show you this. As you well know, there are several legal bases in the treaty which mandate the legislator to provide for minimum harmonization. So is this something special? Does this have any consequences if this is placed in the treaty, this mandate? And fourthly, I asked myself, so what are the procedural instruments that the legislator has at its disposal to control what the member states then do when they have this freedom to enact stricter measures? So what are the procedural ways to discipline the member states, if you want? And as we will see, there's several ways, and as we will also see, or as I think this procedural side is one thing which is a little bit ignored in the past in articles on harmonization. So, I'll try to keep track of the time. So, just briefly, the framework is clear. So, we have the Constitution. Constitution provides for legal basis, provides for competence rules. So, it tells us what the legislator can do. Then we have Then we have secondary law, based on these legal basis, and this often determines what type of harmonization is used or was meant to be used. And then following this, what kind of regulatory discretion the member states are left with. And how this discretion, how this leeway is used then by the member states is again subject to the fundamental freedoms, which are themselves interpreted in light of the treaties, thus the Constitution. So it's sort of like a cycle It's like everything is depending on each other in this equation. So what I perceive as the problems in this discussion is that there's a variety of concepts and regulatory models we talk about, and so there's lots of articles talking about harmonization and what kinds of harmonization there are. There's also articles to talk about what country of origin principle is, or what mutual recognition is, and I think this all is linked. So we have to see it as in total. Yeah, we have to see the big picture, and the big picture shows that there are some striking similarities or parallels. Second problem I think is that there is unclear terminology. So there's lots of terms flying around, and often they're not really precisely giving us the information what's at issue. Thirdly, we still don't know after so many years what the discretion of the legislator is, what the legislator can do in ways of drafting its legal acts. So how legal acts can be drafted in order to stand before the European Court of Justice. You know, there's still doubts on that. And this is because there's inconsistent case law. So there's some case law which tells you this, and there's other case law which tells you a different story, and you don't know what's the reason for this difference is. And I'm gonna show you a little bit of that, of course. And then there's two problems, which are a little bit perhaps ignored in most papers on this subject, which is firstly this the external side, the external competence perspective. And there, of course, is one, because every directive has an effect on external competences. It's the ERTA jurisprudence. So, but exactly how and what effect, that's a different matter. And then finally, there is these procedural questions I wanted to talk about. And in my presentation, I'm gonna draw on mainly on two legal acts. And this is the first one is the Services Directive, and I've written about that in the Services book, where there has been a flyer outside. And the second one is the Tobacco Products Directive. Tobacco Products Directive, firstly, because most of the landmark cases on this harmonization field have been about the tobacco products, tobacco advertising. And secondly, because there's now a new directive out on which I worked. And so it gave me some food for thought, if you want. And it's, of course, it's already been brought before the court. So we can be sure that there's going to be a judgment on Article 114 and tobacco. So that's absolutely definite. So briefly, the outline. So I'm going to start with harmonization as a regulatory model, then terminology. Then I'm going to talk about these different forms of harmonization, how I call them. So I call full harmonization, and there's other words for that, as I'm going to come to in a second. Then I'm going to talk about what I call legislative minimum harmonization. So it means minimum harmonization prescribed by secondary law. And then going to talk about constitutional minimum harmonization, which is a minimum harmonization mandated by the treaty. Then I'm going to talk about the standard of review. So what standard of review is applied to measures taken by the member states in all these different contexts. Then I talk about preemption briefly, because, of course, that's also, this is this external perspective I was mentioning before. Then procedural variables, and then summary and conclusions. And I don't have a watch, so if somebody points me at if my time. That's fine. I got it.
Sure.
Yep. So, a regulatory model, just briefly, also in the WTO context, people speak about harmonization. So, for example, provisions in the sanitary and phytosanitary measures agreement and the DPT, technical barriers to trade agreement, the WTO, these are supposed to be harmonization provisions. Provisions meant to harmonize laws of the WTO members. And there's also a case, appellate body decision, EC hormones, where it's stated that that the objective of this Article 3 of the SPS agreement is to foster harmonization of the measures of the member states of the WTO. But we have to be clear that what is meant in the WTO when they speak about harmonization is purely negative harmonization. It's not positive harmonization. So in WTO, there is nothing like there's nothing like directives, nothing like legal acts enforcing the WTO members to align their national laws. But one should take note that there is the same concept which already also exists in the WTO. So it's not a European law prerogative to talk about harmonization. Then you can say some things about mutual recognition and harmonization, means the relationship between those two. And I'm going to come back to that later on as well. But in the literature, it has been written that mutual recognition is a substitute for harmonization. If harmonization fails, or is not sought for, or is not like aimed at in the first place. So then, if you can't get harmonization, then you go for mutual recognition as a second best, if you want. It has also been written that it's a precursor to harmonization because you could say that if there's already mutual recognition, then you have like mounting pressure from the market to harmonize. So producers and market players then would apply pressure on politicians to go for harmonization, because pretty much it's the anyway they have to adjust, and so if they have to adjust, then it can also be done like fully. And I would argue that this might maybe true for the goods market, the second precursor argument. And albeit even there, the evidence is patchy. You know, there's not too many cases have been shown to have had this this effect. Yeah. And I would certainly argue it's not true for the services market, because if you think of professional qualifications think of services of general economic interest, then there's no appetite for harmonization on them. So we're left with mutual recognition or something else. Yeah. So I think there's differences between the fields here, if you make this argument. The third, certainly can be a combination of both, so there can be combinations. And if you look at, for example, the Medicinal Products Directive, this directive shows, or this regime shows, that mutual recognition, harmonization can nicely work together, because with medicinal products, as you might know, the licensing regime is harmonized for most medicinal products. So the reasons for refusing the marketing of pharmaceuticals is regulated by the directive. However, the license can be issued decentrally by one member state, and in which case the decision by the so-called member states of reference, so by all other member states, by the one member state that has given the license, this decision must be recognized by the other member states. So only if the other member states do not recognize, then the Commission decides centrally. So there's a combination of harmonized requirements for licensing in the directive, plus then a sort of mutual recognition system with regard to medicinal products. So that's a nice example, I think, of a combination of those two. And fourthly, you could ask yourself, can it be the same? Can mutual recognition be the same as harmonization? And I will show that you could make this argument with regard to minimum harmonization. With minimum harmonization, with a market access clause, that is. And I'm going to come to that. it has been argued that that a move, a shift from full harmonization, a shift from minimum harmonization to full harmonization is sort of would entail a radical change from a cooperative model of legislating to a hierarchical model. And Wetherill has made this argument. And I think it's a difficult argument to make, because cooperation firstly means several things. It can mean interaction, it can mean collaboration. And with all directives, you have interaction of legal orders. And with most directives, you have collaboration between the Commission and the member states in order to make the regime work. So per definition, it's in all respects a cooperative regulatory instrument. And what is meant, of course, by Wetherill is whether it's more like that minimum harmonization, of course, provides for a more decentralized a regime than full harmonization. So that's, I guess, what the difference is here. And here's a trade-off, because there's a trade-off between legal certainty. When there are uniform rules, you have legal certainty in the market, and the lack thereof, because in order to agree on those rules, you have to compromise on clarity, on legal clarity in the instruments. So yeah, you always, and that's also deployed by Wetherill. So there's always a trade-off between central and decentral approach to regulating the market. Yeah, this just goes to show how many terms you have in this area. Yeah, what's in use. Yeah. So full harmonization is obviously opposite to minimum harmonization. And it has been argued that harmonization can always be only partial, because it can always only regulate a certain field, can never fully regulate the field. But I mean, if you look at the services directive, that do not argue in both directions, because the claim is certainly to harmonize the full field of services. But then, of course, in reality, there are so many exceptions that it did not happen. But I think it's a little bit misleading point to make if you say there cannot be full harmonization in terms of the scope of a measure. So partial harmonization is best understood, in my opinion, as the opposite to full harmonization in terms of the regulatory field covered, the scope. And however, partial harmonization has also been seen as a heading for all forms of minimum harmonizations, and by others as a model where only exports have to conform to the harmonized rules. So partial harmonization obviously is a especially tricky term to use, and perhaps should be, perhaps not so informative. Optional harmonization is sometimes referred to for minimum harmonization without market access. And Slot, in an article quite long ago, has in contrast defined optional harmonization as a model that leaves the producer the choice whether to comply with the national or with the harmonized rules, which is of course not really happening in practice. But and alternative harmonization gives the member states several options how to reach the directive's objective, and that's also not very relevant. And then there's vertical versus horizontal, which is I guess clear. So where does this leave us? I mean, I want to refer to full harmonization when I mean the scope, more or less, and I will refer to absolute harmonization when I mean the intensity of harmonization. But I mean, that's not and partial then is the opposite to full, and minimum is the opposite to absolute. But I just wanted to highlight that it's a little bit many terms flying around here. So full harmonization can either concern the breadth or the depth of the measure. So the scope or the intensity, in other words. And how do we know whether a measure is fully harmonizing? Yeah, this can be implicit. It can it can require interpretation by the court. The Gallagher case is a case in point. In this case, it was about, again, tobacco. Britain provided for larger text warnings on the surface of the cigarette pack, while the directive only allowed for warnings on at least 4%, and UK allowed for 6%, or required 6%. And the court, I think, not surprisingly, said, okay, this is permissible. The e-money directive even has a provision that says full harmonization. So sometimes it's very clear. Sometimes it has to be interpreted. Sometimes it's very clear from the heading of a provision in a secondary law act. Blacklists, I think, are an interesting example of full harmonization, because they are, by definition, full harmonization. As soon as you have a blacklist, then yes, nothing else can happen on member state level. And I think this is not enough appreciated, what kind of radical incursion into regulatory autonomy these blacklists provide for. And one of the examples is the Unfair Commercial Practices Directive, and which I'm also coming back to. And another example is in the Services Directive of blacklists. And there can be targeted full harmonization. And in this case, a legal act would have a clear statement on what it harmonizes, fully harmonizes, and then it would say what member states are free to act on. So it would explain sort of to the member states, okay, we wanted to do that, and you can take these issues. So an example is in the Consumer Credit Directive. Safeguard clauses. Clauses. What are those that allow member states to act despite full harmonization? And they are sort of the exception to the rule, and that's why they do not undermine a qualification as a full harmonization measure. But the big difference is there's no national reinforcement under full harmonization. So these are sort of three perhaps contested issues in this respect. So the country of origin principle has been in the Commission proposal for the Services Directive. You remember there was this the Commission proposal that was in the Frankenstein draft, Bolkestein. Draft of the Services Directive, there was this provision that said the host member states has to apply the law of the service provider. It's the so-called country of origin principle, which is a misleading term in itself. But it has been argued that this is a close relative to full harmonization, country of origin principle. Vedderill, again, has argued this. And I would caution against this, because we have to be clear that harmonization always requires a positive approximation of laws, while a country of origin principle in the form of the services, in the form of the proposal for the services directive, is, if you want, a rule of a conflict of laws rule, or perhaps a mutual recognition rule, but it's not, I think, a harmonization rule. And we will see that we could just as well qualify a country of origin principle as a form of minimum harmonization with market access clause. I'll come back to that. So, in the final services directive, in the one that was eventually adopted, The directive does not clearly state what kind of measure it wants to be. There's no provision on harmonization, full harmonization. There are several different messages which are sent by the legislator here. First, there's a safeguard clause, which normally is part of a full harmonization measure in Article 18. But then the directive also speaks about targeted harmonization, coordination, mutual recognition, all sorts of things, but not harmonization. There's one part of the Services Directive in Chapter 5, which is on information obligations, where you could argue this is fully harmonized. So on this specific aspect, the directive seeks to harmonize member state laws. But especially the Article 16 of the Services Directive, to which I will come back to, which provides for freedom to provide services in deviation from the treaty rules, so sort of modifies the treaty freedom in an act of secondary law. This, in my opinion, is not harmonization. It's also not minimum harmonization because there's no floor or no a ceiling put up by the legislator for this. The Tobacco Products Directive is another recent example, which where you could ask yourself, so what exactly is this? As I will come back to, the Tobacco Products Directive regulates tobacco products and nicotine-containing products, and it clearly states, for one, in a recital, that member states could regulate and ban paraphernalia used for tobacco products, including water pipes, and could regulate ban products resembling in appearance a type of tobacco or related product, which are this famous cigarette, chocolate sticks in the form of cigarettes, for example. So these are no tobacco products. So this is a sort of like a clear statement on what's within the scope of the directive. So it explains the harmonization part of the directive. But in the directive, as we will see, there's also a provision on minimum harmonization. So the legislative minimum harmonization part. There's this nice term, gold plating, for stricter measures by member states under a directive. So it's gold plating. And there's a trend, it has been claimed, there's a trend towards full harmonization. And that may be true, but it's only for consumer rights or in the consumer area. And in there, indeed, the Consumer Rights Directive has more or less repealed like three other directives, doorstep selling directive, distance selling directive, which was before minimum harmonization acts, has made of this a full harmonization regime. And this is also clearly stated in Article 4 of Consumer Rights Directive. Unfair Commercial Practices Directive has been a precursor of this shift in the approach by the legislator. And as I mentioned, it contains a blacklist for unprohibited commercial practices, which is clearly fully harmonizing. So now you have a choice with legislative minimum harmonization to either have a market access clause or no market access clause. And with the first, you have reinforcement only for domestic cases, domestic products, domestic selling arrangements. And the result is more or less a recognition obligation, because you have to recognize what's coming into your member state as long as it conforms to the directive. And it's important to understand that that's a crucial difference. With the market access clause, you have to grant access to products when they conform to a directive. With a country of origin principle, you have to you have to apply the foreign law, which can amount basically to the same when it's about products, because then you just, so the product carries its domestic law regime with it. But with the country of origin principle, you have to allow products into your member state which are above, which are under a regime which is perhaps different from the directive. It's there can of course be regulations in the state of origin which do not conform or which go above the directive. And so if we think of the case with the services directive and the argument made by Wetherill, if you take this chapter 5 on information obligations in the services directive and you say this is fully harmonizing, and and then if you add a country of origin principle, then you would have to allow services providers into your country which at least, of course, have to comply with these information obligations, but which could have all kinds of different other rules which they are subject to. And if you have a market access clause, then you would simply have to allow service providers or products in other cases that conform to the directive, full stop. That's then the benchmark of your review internally. And with a market access clause, you would not apply a foreign law. You would not have. That was one of the criticisms with regard to country of origin principle, because you would have a domestic court would have to apply a foreign law to in case of a dispute about the services of the service provider. Yeah, no market access clause would mean reinforcements also apply to export to imports. Just briefly, I mean that there's quite some case law on stricter measures of member states under such legal acts, and in most cases lawfulness has been confirmed, and there's quite a lot of articles recasting, retelling these judgments. So I'm not gonna go into detail here. But what is I think what is striking is that the cases on the top here, Boet, Tokmaris, Ospan, Quelle, these have all been cases in the consumer area. So these have been cases about consumer rights, more or less about selling arrangements, if you want. The cases on the bottom were on the tobacco advertising directive and there the court was quite unclear about what the standard of review is. In one case, in the first case, it said it seemed to say that the market access clause is decisive. Well, the lack of the market access clause is decisive for annulling the tobacco advertising directive. And in the follow-up case, it seemed to say that since the legislator now sort of adopted a new directive and it contained a market access clause, then it was okay. And you could argue that this was not the decisive point in these judgments, and this has also been made. The argument has been made in several articles. So, but I tend to agree that that there are other aspects, other issues have been more important in these judgments than the existence or non-existence of the market access clause. But you could ask yourself, so what's the distinguishing aspect here between the cases on top and the tobacco advertising cases? And it might be that that even so, tobacco advertising, of course, is also a selling arrangement. It's also about selling the product. It's not about the product itself. Even so, you could argue that this was closer to the product's market. This was closer to product regulation than the cases on on top, at least with Ausbank, these consumer rights cases. But the picture is certainly not very clear. And Laval is another disturbance in the case law, which I'm not going into detail now because it would take too far. And but Laval also would see as a case out. In a specific context. Constitutional minimum harmonization, these are the legal basis in the treaty. You see social policy, consumer policy, environment, and the wording is pretty similar. And the treaty mandates that there should be a high level of protection. Not the highest, because otherwise you wouldn't need those minimum harmonization mandate anymore. Now, if you look at the Article 168, this is about measures setting high standards of quality and safety of organs and blood and tissue. So quite a specific area, but I think it nicely illustrates a point. There's a directive based on this, which is the blood directive, and it allows reinforcements quite in line with Articles 168. Now you could ask yourself, so does this mean, or would it be possible to have a market access clause in such a directive? Would it be permissible to allow for blood from other member states to enter the market as long as it only complies with the directive? I think it would not. I think that you could make a point that it would not be permissible to have a market access clause in this case, because it's a difference whether the there's a treaty mandate for minimum harmonization and whether there is only the decision by the legislator to do that. The decision by the legislator under Article 114 might be legal, might be permissible to do that, but there's still a difference, in my opinion. And there was sort of a test case, but then in the end it wasn't. What would happen if you have one regime which is fully harmonizing, which is medicinal products regime, as I have already mentioned, and you have another regime, secondary law regime, which provides for minimum harmonization. And so medicinal products under Article 114 and blood directive under Article 168, and you have a conflict for one, and one product falls under both regimes. Would you then have to argue that stricter measures by member states must be allowed because it's constitutionally mandated? Or what kind of regime would prevail here? The fully harmonized or the constitutionally minimum harmonized regime? In Octa Pharma, the court didn't have to decide that, but it's an interesting experiment of sort. So what's the standard of review? Outside of the scope of a directive, the fundamental freedoms apply. That's easy. That's case Denkavit. If you have full harmonization under Article 114, then you have a specific regime, a quite strict regime. 114, paragraphs 4 and 5 apply. Especially, you have the requirement there must be a specific problem for a member state to enact new measures in paragraph 5. Full harmonization on any other basis, the court has always said that the specific interest for protection must be satisfied by the legal act. So in order to know whether member states have still freedom to act, you have to examine whether what the directive regulates already takes care of those concerns, if you want, that member states might have in a certain area. If this is not the case, then fundamental freedoms, and then you could ask yourself, what about the specific problem of a member state? Is this then a requirement or not? I would say rather not, because there's no, yeah, we don't just don't see any hint for that. And then again, you could ask yourself, so Article 16 of the Services Directive, when it takes away or when it modifies the treaty regime, is this really permissible? Because it takes away consumer protection as a just reason of justification without really making sure, or perhaps making sure, that the directive takes away all needs for the member states to rely on this justification. It's just a blanco cut, if you want, cut off on that. Yeah. So it's not really in line with Hedley-Lomas and Monsees. Reinforcement measures under legislative minimum harmonization, and then they always are without a market access clause. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about justification here. Because if products from other states can enter the market, if they comply with the directive, and products from other member states have to comply with the directive before they enter the market. Then the freedoms apply, but what if you have a different justification regime? What if the legislator just creates a different justification regime for these stricter measures? And you could argue if there is under 114 a specific regime and the legislator allows an illegal act for stricter measures, then normally you would say, but there's a regime for that in 114, so how can you deviate from that? But in practice, this happens, and it has happened in the old Tobacco Products Directive, and it happens in the new one as well. So there's a different wording on what member states can do in order to save or in order to justify the introduction of new measures. And then you have cases under constitutional minimum harmonization. And I think this has been not really looked at so far in this context. And in my opinion, these cases show, this Deponiezweckverband and Bazane, they show that the standard of review is different in these cases. They only check for, the court mentioned something of coherence, it must be coherent. Yeah? And it says that it doesn't really need to look at proportionality, because member states have a broad discretion when the treaty allows them minimum harmonization. So in these two cases, there's a completely different standard of review than in cases under legislative minimum harmonization. Yeah, just briefly, that's the new Tobacco Products Directive. And if you read this, then yeah, it's not easy, because the first paragraph it says it basically is a market access clause in the first paragraph, but it says subject to paragraphs 2 and 3, and paragraph 2 then allows reinforcements in for specific reasons. For in relation to the standardization of the packaging, which should allow plain packaging, yeah, which means Australian model, cold pack is standardized. The industry hates it, yeah, and that should be allowed. But then I would say for this there would be no market access, because it's under Article Paragraph 1, it falls under the disclaimer under paragraph 1. And in paragraph 3, then you have something which is very similar to Article 114, paragraph 5, in wording. And it refers to a specific problem of member state, and it refers to sort of stricter measures which go very far, which can prohibit, straight up prohibit, certain products. So it's a mix yeah, of different approaches. And I see my time is I'm running out of time, so I'm gonna skip that the preemption part. It's just one sentence. There's one problem. If you have an international agreement, which sets a minimum standard, which is then binding on the member states because of ERTA, and at the same time you have a EU legal act which sets a minimum standard, then you can ask yourselves, okay, what happened? What's the standard then? What member states are still allowed to do? What happens if the EU legal act then doesn't stand because it's not? So I think that's something which hasn't been explored or hasn't been thought of too much. That's also quite very briefly just give you some idea procedural variants. I've already mentioned Article 114, paragraph 4 and 5, very strict, very limited. Member states nearly don't have any chance to make the case under paragraph 5 for new measures. Austria tried in GMOs and failed. And they are conditions of validity. So these procedures, member states have to comply with them. Otherwise, the measure is not valid. And then you have, in contrast, sharp contrast to that, you have mere notification obligations for reinforcements based on the other legal basis, social policy, environment. If you read the treaty, it's simple notifications. It's nothing comparable to Article 114. And then you have all sorts of things in secondary law. You have a standstill obligation and a condition of validity in the technical requirements directive. You have a screening right in services directive, and you have standstill and a tacit approval rule in the TPD. So, yeah, quite different things for the same purpose. So my last point, my summary is there's a close relation between harmonization theory and regulatory approaches, which is perhaps sometimes not fully appreciated, in my opinion. Yes, things amount to the same, but are called differently. Then you have you see tectonic shifts in regulatory approaches, full harmonization to minimum harmonization, so minimum to full harmonization. But we should be clear that this is only in certain fields. This is not a general phenomenon. Legality of legislative minimum harmonization, does it vary between fields? Is there a certain distinguishing element between the tobacco advertising cases and the consumer rights cases? Does the standard for constitutional minimum harmonization differ from that for legal legislative minimum harmonization? I think so, I do. And I've shown you some variations on procedures, which I think we will have to observe in the future to know what's going on in this field. Thank you. Yeah.